It'll take some time. Don't eat any more fish.
Don't worry. I'm not eating any more of that damn fish.
Hey, vet, don't sweat about it, Carlos said. I'm sure a quick regrow in the revival machine will solve everything.
Harris glared at him. There were times in the past when Harris had given us just such sage advice. Carlos moved a little closer to Harris. The veteran stood up, glaring at everyone.
You want to help me out?
Carlos asked quietly, fingering his rifle suggestively. I'd been wondering up until that point why Harris hadn't responded to Carlos's jibes. It turned out that he'd been keeping quiet to lure his tormentor in. Suddenly, Harris lashed out with long arms, grabbed Carlos, and slammed his gauntlet into the open faceplate. Carlos spit blood and staggered away. Adjunct Leeson walked over to see what was happening, and Harris nonchalantly reached over and slammed Carlos's faceplate shut. Leeson eyed the slurry of blood running down Carlos's breastplate.
Is there some kind of problem, veteran?
Nothing I can't handle, sir.
How's that fish doing for you?
Just like Mom's cooking back home. But there are some toxins involved. The bio says they can process them out, but we can't eat the stuff straight out of the water.
Pity,
Leeson said, eyeing the lake. The rockfish were back, looking at us with their invisible optical organs. We'd figured out with further observation that they did have eyes, but they weren't like ours. They were more like exposed light-sensitive nerve centers, clusters of bulbous cells that allowed them to sense light and motion, but didn't really give their brains a solid image the way ours did. As we watched, one of the fish yawned. They did that from time to time, opening the forward third of their bodies to reveal neat twin rows of brownish triangular teeth.
If you can't keep up, Leeson told Harris, we'll have to send you back to the lifter for processing. I can't have a poisoned veteran on my line.
Not necessary, adjunct. I'm feeling fine.
Good, keep it that way.
After a breakfast of rations, the canyon warmed up and became dank. The heat increased steadily until it was oppressive. Everyone's suit air conditioners were running, eating battery power, but we couldn't do anything about that. We'd get heat stroke if we turned them off. The days on this planet were long, about 29 hours long. When we landed, the sun had been setting, and the environment had been cooling down. We hadn't yet felt the full heat of midday.
New orders, people,
Adjunct Leeson said after reporting in.
We're to circumnavigate the lake.
A prolonged chorus of groans and curses swept the group.
What, were you guys planning on putting your feet up? Sorry to disappoint. Let's move out. Gorman, you take point, the rest of you stay awake. This isn't going to be a nature walk. Keep your weapons primed for discharge.
We began trekking around the lake, pushing over the ever-thickening plant growths. As we went, we discovered groves of plants that weren't flowering types. They were big things that looked like pineapples the size of barrels. I wondered if they might be another possible foodstuff, but didn't dare mention it to anyone. I didn't want to be the next lucky taste tester. Anne walked with me, and she paused to take samples of the pineapple things. The meat inside looked juicy, but was greenish rather than yellow. She noticed me staring and waiting for her. She hurried up, stashed her sample, and walked with me again.
We don't want the adjunct to get any more ideas, she said to me.
Yeah, I agreed. He'd poison half the squad before he's done. We marched around the lake until we reached the far side sometime in the afternoon. It felt like the longest day of the year to me already, and it wasn't even close to over. On this side of the canyon, the water was closer to the cliff-like walls. Broken stones and dunes of dust had accumulated here. What I don't get is why this entire hole in the ground never filled up with sand, I said to Anne.
I'm not sure about that myself,
she said, staring at the soaring cliffs.
I guess the cauldron must erupt occasionally.
I looked at her in alarm.
Erupt?
Yes, of course. You do realize that we're inside the throat of a volcano, don't you? Every once in a while it hiccups and then fills back up with water from underground aquifers. Hiccups? As in, blasts lava into the sky? Right. I thought about that, and I found I didn't like the implications. She was saying we were inside a dormant volcano. That explained the sinkhole-like lake. And I understood that the water on this world was underground for the most part, but knowing that I might be consumed in a gush of fire at any second didn't do anything for my nerves. A few minutes later, I got the surprise of my day. I spotted someone. Someone who wasn't part of our squad. There was no doubt she was human. She was mostly naked, too. She had scraps of leathery cloth wrapped around the most important parts, but that was it. She was young, I could tell that. Full-grown, but probably a little younger than I was. I didn't shout because I was stunned. I saw her crouching on a rock near the wall of the canyon, watching us. There was something in her hands, something which she lifted and directed toward me. There was a snapping sound. For a brief second, I thought she'd thrown a stick at me. Then the crossbow bolt stuck in my armor, and the point rasped and clattered, bouncing off my breastplate. If I'd been a light trooper, I might have been killed. I shouted an alarm and signaled the rest of the squad. But when I turned back toward the girl to point her out, she'd vanished.
Chapter 13. At first, I don't think anyone believed me. But they examined the projectile the girl had fired at me, and they had to admit that none of us had brought a weapon like that from Earth. "This is a big deal," Adjunct Leeson kept saying over and over again. He ordered us to close our faceplates and circle up, with our eyes turned toward the jungle-like plant growth. We did so while he stood in the middle and reported the sighting to the Centurion, and then to the Primus herself. "They want to talk to you," Leeson said. "I'm patching you in. Don't screw me by saying anything stupid, McGill."
No, sir."
A moment later, I was on the line with Primus Turov. She sounded agitated.
"What kind of stunt is this, McGill?" she demanded. "How can you possibly have found the colonists and then lost them again?"
"The colonists?" I asked, taken by surprise. But as I thought about it, I realized she was probably right. The girl must have been a member of the lost colonists we'd come to rescue or to exterminate, as the case may be. I'd been expecting astronauts of some kind, not primitives.
"The colonists attacked you, I'm certain of it. That officially classifies them as hostile."
"It all might have been a misunderstanding, Primus," I said. "I don't think..."
"You aren't paid to think, McGill,"
she interrupted.
"No reported sightings have come in from other canyons. None of the other cohorts have made contact. I need your team to communicate with them more meaningfully."
"Well, I can confirm that they aren't much of a threat," I said. "They can't fight worth a damn against our equipment using crossbows."
"You aren't qualified to determine what constitutes a threat," she snapped. "The colonists are a huge problem, but it seems they aren't a widespread one, at least. I'm giving your squad new orders, effective immediately. You're to find their base camp and befriend these colonists. Do you read me, Leeson?"
"Yes, sir,"
Leeson said quickly. He was patched into the conversation, but had been keeping quiet.
"We'll find them."
"See that you do. Turov out."
I was kicked out of the chat line then without so much as an over and out. I described the conversation to Anne.
"They've clearly regressed over the years," she said of the colonists. "What I wouldn't give to do a full write-up on them. Possibly the regression started while their ship was still in flight to this system."
"I don't care about studying them," I said. "They're human. They're in trouble. And they're just as trapped here as we are. We need to offer them our protection, not march around scaring them to death in metal suits."
"Well, I wouldn't go near that girl bare-chested," Anne told me. "She'll put an arrow through your sternum without hesitating."
"They're probably just scared,"
I argued. Look, Anne said, her face worried. I know how you must feel. That girl looked young and harmless, but she's probably more like a wild animal than an Earth girl by now.
What are you talking about? Why is everyone so down on our own colonists?
First of all, they could get our species erased. If they screw up, we might get blamed for it. The Galactics don't care about the details. Humanity is like a school of fish to them. We're all the same. They'll remove us if we irritate them.
I'd heard this kind of talk before, and I'd become pretty irritated with the Galactics myself over the years. But I knew enough about Legion politics not to say things that were against established policy.
I get that part, I said. But we aren't even trying to treat them like lost friends or like people who need our help. What about your oath to heal? Doesn't that extend to them as well?
Anne looked troubled by that.
I suppose it does.
And I don't know why everyone thinks they're animals. Maybe we just like thinking that, so we'll feel less guilty about pushing them around.
It's more than that, she said. I've read up on the history of the colony mission to Zeta Herculus as we flew out here. The people aboard the ship itself were separatists. Folks their own governments didn't want around. They didn't like the new way of things. They resisted worldwide government, and many of them were volunteered to colonize the stars for precisely that reason.
I hadn't known about that, but it made sense. Even before the Galactics had shown up and annexed Earth, we'd been crunching down into blocks of nations. Currencies had merged, as had political entities. Many nations were only partly in control of their own destinies. My grandparents had protested the changes and been put on government shit lists for years afterwards.
I studied the likely social progress of the Hydra mission in school, Anne told me. It was part of every psychologist's dream to interview these people again, but it was assumed the mission was lost. Just think about it, James. They took off in 2041, just 11 years before the Galactics arrived and delivered their ultimatum to Earth. That's more than 80 years ago.
Yeah, so you're saying that none of the original colonists are alive, right?
Right. Only adults flew. Even accounting for relativistic effects, I doubt there's a single colonist who can recall standing on their home world.
I thought about that, and I could see what she was getting at. These people wouldn't be like us. They couldn't be. Cut off and flying in normal space without a warp drive system, they'd traveled at sub-light speeds all the way out here. The long journey and the many subsequent decades they'd spent on this dusty rock would change them drastically.
But they're still human, I insisted. Genetically, yes, but not culturally. They might be barbarians now. After today's encounter, that looks very likely. Humans, but feral humans, wild humans. People like nothing we've ever had to deal with before. The last truly wild humans on Earth died out a century ago.
We'd reached the jumbled pile of rocks that had formed at the base of the cliffs. Dusty and hot, I didn't find it a pleasant spot in which to be. We looked around, and it wasn't until our point man, Gorman, fell into a hole and vanished that we figured out what we were looking for.
They're underground, I shouted. Look for caves, tunnels.
When we found Gorman, he wasn't moving. We dragged him back into the sunlight and opened his visor. His eyes were closed, and there was blood trickling from his mouth.
Retreat off these rocks, roared Veteran Harris.
We dragged Gorman with help from two other troopers. Our armored gauntlets whined and protested, giving us the strength to carry the man. Heavy troopers typically weighed in at over 500 kilos in their full kit. Specialist Ann Grant was there the moment we had him off the rocks.
Some kind of trap, Carlos said. That has to be what it was. He just fell in and disappeared. The ground ate him and killed him. But there wasn't an explosion. Couldn't have been a mine. Weirdest damn thing I ever saw.
Shut up and give him some air, shouted Harris.
Gorman's face didn't even twitch as Anne opened up his breastplate and looked him over.
There's a wound here, at the base of the neck. My tapper shows his suit was breached.
How? I asked.
at the joints. Something chewed its way in. Look.
We all did, and we didn't like what we saw. A small hole was right there in the black polymer cusps that formed the joints in the armor. Our suits weren't made entirely of metal. They had smart cloth components inside and hard polymer interlocking tubes at the joints.
Something cut its way in,
Harris said, fingering a hole in the black tubing.
Yeah, Carlos agreed. Then it ate its way into Gorman. Could it be some kind of acid?
No vapor, Anne said. No chemical traces either. I'm not a tech, but I'd say it was a nanite swarm of some kind.
We frowned at one another. Leeson walked up and put his hands on his hips.
Is he dead?
No, sir, not quite, Anne replied. I might be able to save him, but there's something burrowing into his skull right now. I've got it on my internal vibroscope.
She showed the officer her instruments. I winced just thinking about it. The man had a worm in him, a metal worm of smart microscopic robots. Leeson shook his head.
We're not screwing around with that, he said. I'm declaring this man dead. Call it in, Grant.
But, sir, he's still...
Leeson pulled out his sidearm and discharged it into Gorman's face. He kept the trigger down, causing wisps of steam and smoke to rise up. He made sure that the probe digging into Gorman's suit was destroyed. Anne looked pissed off. I didn't blame her. It was always hard to watch our officers kill one of our own. I imagined that for a bio dedicated to healing, it was doubly difficult to take.
That was unnecessary and counterproductive, sir, she said.
Yeah, well, Leeson said, write up all your complaints and put them in your report. I'm not taking any chances out here. We've encountered resistance with sophisticated weaponry. I'm going to call this incident in, and then I'm going to blow this entire region of rocks to dust. From space, it will look like a new sandstorm before we're done.
Carlos gave a little happy whoop. A few others echoed it. No one wanted to chase these colonists into the rocks and be eaten by some kind of nano-worm. Anne was examining something else now. I looked it over, and I realized it was the arrow that had struck my chest. She eyed the point critically.
This is made of the same material, she said. Nanites, programmed to eat their way through any flexible soft points in armor or flesh. You're lucky it hit your breastplate so squarely, James. It appears the arrowhead didn't activate.
So these primitive colonists aren't so primitive, I said.
Definitely not.
I thought about the encounter and wondered if the girl had really been trying to kill me. Maybe she'd been trying to warn me off. It was hard to say what her intentions were. But either way, I didn't feel good about the idea of blowing up these people without giving them a chance to explain themselves.
Excuse me, adjunct, I heard myself say.
What is it, McGill?
I'm sorry, sir, but I must point out that the Primus ordered us to make contact with these colonists, to befriend them.
Leeson laughed. He pointed down at the mess that had once been Gorman. Already our troops were stripping armor off the corpse. Heavy armor was valuable, and Gorman would need his suit again after he was revived back at the lifter.
Does this look like they're in a friendly mood, specialist? Leeson asked.
No, sir, I admitted. But we're clanking around their home territory in suits of armor, carrying military weapons. Historically speaking, that's not the usual way you make peaceful contact with a native population.
What do you suggest?
I hereby volunteer to approach their tunnels. I'll strip off my armor and my weapons. If they kill me, well, I guess you can revive me back at the lifter.
Don't let them do it, adjunct,
Harris said, coming up to us. His eyes were big and bloodshot. I wondered if last night's dinner was starting to get to him after all. Leeson glanced at Harris, then looked back at me with narrowed eyes.
Are you some kind of kiss-up? He demanded. Or are you just insane?
He's a little of both, Harris said.
Neither, sir, I said. I'm simply following the Primus's orders. I suggest you do the same, sir.
Leeson grumbled but waved me on. He pulled the rest of the squad back to the lake shore where they could watch the show in safety.
Could you move out of sight, sir? I asked him. I think it would be better if you were hidden in the brush.
Is this some kind of crazy dodge?
Leeson shouted back.
Are you planning to go AWOL on this rock? If you are, you won't last a day, McGill.
Nothing like that, sir.
After a bit more grumbling, the squad withdrew. They left me to face the hot rocks alone. I pulled off my armor, piece by piece, while I eyed the quiet rocks. I had some second thoughts at that point. I found myself standing in a smart cloth jumper in front of what had to be a nest of hostile people. All I had in my hands was a strip of white cloth I planned on holding up as a makeshift flag of truce. So far, these colonists had shot me and sprung a sophisticated booby trap. They were bound to have more tricks up their sleeves, if they had sleeves. I wondered what they were afraid of and why they hadn't yet attempted peaceful contact. After all, we were as human as they were. We were the same species. Surely they could see that. I hadn't moved a millimeter in over 30 seconds. My thoughts were interrupted by Leeson, who shouted at me from the plant growth to my left.
Damn it, McGill! Get on with it!
I sighed and began to climb those stark boulders. I felt the heat radiating from them and burning my hands right through my gloves. It was times like these that made me wonder if there was something wrong with my brain. I picked my way over the hot rocks, staying on the large, flat surfaces as much as I could. I avoided open areas of ground and loose gravel, assuming that's where the traps were. I climbed until I was within 50 meters of the cliff itself. Suddenly, I made contact. It happened fast, and it happened with smooth coordination. 6 of the colonists, or hunters, or whatever you want to call them, sprang up from hiding places all around me. I wasn't armed, so I slowly put up my hands and stood there.
"Do you guys speak English?"
I asked, hopefully. They didn't say anything. Up until this point, they'd barely made a sound. They'd come out of dark cracks under the biggest boulders, sliding from under their rocks like scorpions coming out of burrows. None of them spoke or smiled. Instead, they were crouching and staring. Their crossbows were loaded with dark metal bolts, and I had no doubt that a hit from any of those weapons would chew through my flesh. I'd be dead in less than a minute from a minor wound. I kept my hands raised, and I glanced over my shoulder toward the lake shore. I wasn't really surprised to find I couldn't see my comrades from here. There were a few key boulders between this spot and their position.
"Your litter mates can't help you now," said one of the group. "We have your twisted life, and we will end it."
I thought I recognized her. She had long hair, and even longer, tanned legs. She was the one that had shot me the first time.
"We don't mean you any harm," I said.
"You will die no matter what you say."
The colonists were a motley bunch. They had skins tanned a deep brown, hair that was pulled back in knotted tangles and bows held tightly. I could see their corded muscles outstanding on every arm and neck. They were very tense. I lowered my hands and shrugged.
"Well then, get on with it. Why haven't you killed me yet?"
"Your masters have trained you well," the woman said. "This is a new tactic, and I don't understand it yet. We hesitate, waiting for your trick to play out. We must learn so we can warn others. Your kind has invaded many valleys at once this time, but your purpose is unclear. Whatever it is, you will not be successful."
I frowned, not knowing what the hell she was talking about.
"You sound like you've seen our kind before. We're the first ones to come here. We're from Earth, just as your parents were."
This statement seemed to surprise the girl. She gave a bark of laughter. The others hooted and bared their teeth in amusement. I got the feeling they weren't dumb, but they definitely lost some social skills somewhere along the way out from Earth.
"So strange," she said. "You do seem to be unlike the others. How can you know of Earth? How can you know of our name for that place?
Kill it now, Della, said one of the men suddenly. He was a hunched fellow with white, wispy hair circling his head like cotton. His eyes were wide and staring. He moved his feet constantly, shuffling on the stones. Instead of a bow, he had a cocked and loaded crossbow trained on my back. He never shifted his aim away from me. My skin crawled as if it knew it had never had so many deadly weapons aimed at it at once.
I'm in command, Stott, Della said. I say, not yet.
Be sure, be safe,
said another younger male. He was maybe 14, and there was no pity in his youthful eyes. I took it that he was agreeing with Stott.
Be sure, be safe,
they all muttered, as if saying a prayer. Even Della seemed compelled to repeat the chorus. I looked around the group. They flinched as my eyes fell upon them.
What are you people so afraid of? I demanded. Ever since we got here, you've been hiding, and now you're taking shots at us. We haven't killed any of your folk. Why kill us? We have ships and weapons. Don't give my commanders cause to harm you. We could wipe you out if we wanted to.
It threatens us, shouted Stott.
He lifted his crossbow higher, sighting along the stock as if I was a kilometer away.
Della, we must kill it now, before it learns more from us. Clearly, it is a spy.
I'm not an it, I said. I'm James McGill, a weaponeer from Legion Varus. I'm a soldier from Earth. If you'll let me, I'll help you.
Now you sound like one from the litters, Della said. Except you should not have a name. That's unnatural. Can it be that the cephalopods are trying to create beings that mirror our ways? You're so thin and small of stature. I don't understand you. How can you be the way you are?
I shook my head. I don't understand you either. But you said something about cephalopods? That's a squid, right? Are you talking about the aliens, the walking squids? That was the wrong thing to say. They hissed and squirmed around me, clearly not liking any reference to space squids.
You see, Stott shouted, he's one of them. Don't be fooled. He's allied with them.
I was really starting to dislike Stott, but I decided it was best to ignore his outbursts and focus on Della, who appeared to be in charge.
The squids attacked us, I said. They attacked our ships as we came here from Earth. They damaged our ship, but we were able to escape on lifters, the small ships that came here to land. We landed in your valleys because they were the only places where we could survive. We didn't even know you were here. You were supposed to colonize the water world.
How can you listen to his twisting lies? Demanded Stott. They've improved their techniques, that's all. He'll want you to mate with him. That's next. He'll turn you into a brood mother. See if he won't.
Della's dark, intelligent eyes swung to Stott, then back to me.
How did they teach you all this? Could you once have been a captive child? If so, you must have been raised since you were a pup, making it all the more odd. Small children don't have the ability to discuss space. The cephalopods themselves must have taught you this story.
At least Della seemed intrigued with me. She narrowed her eyes and stared at me as if I was some kind of a deep puzzle. The idea that I was really from Earth didn't seem to be sinking in at all. On a hunch, I reached into one of my pockets. They all tensed around me.
Easy, I said. I'm unarmed. I only want to show you something.
I drew out a knife. It was the one my dad had given me before I left home. I held it out toward Della.
Take it, I said. It's from Earth. Can you read?
She snorted at me.
Of course I can read.
See the inscription? It says Made in North America Sector. That's real old-fashioned Pittsburgh steel.
She frowned at the knife and then at me.
You can't have this thing. No captive child would be given such a treasure from the old world. No littermate could have it either.
It's from Earth, I said.
My dad gave it to me. I could see in her eyes that she was baffled, but she was starting to believe. I smiled at her. That was a mistake. Stott, who'd been watching the interchange very closely, chose that moment to fire his crossbow. The bolt tore through my back and lodged itself in my ribs. I looked down, stunned. The head of the bolt was wet, dark metal. I could see a chunk of bone there as well. I sank to my knees. There was a sick explosion inside my body, a cold feeling. Not pain yet, not exactly. It felt as if I had a new bone protruding outward from inside my chest. The nanite head of the bolt activated then. It must have sensed the nearness of flesh, bone, and blood. It crawled into my skin. I put my hand over it, trying to tug it out, but it was wedged in pretty well. I felt the head of the bolt bite my hand, and I tried to pull away, but I couldn't. I howled. My hand had been fused to the wound in my chest. It was worse, I thought, to know what was happening. I envied dumb animals, creatures that just thrashed without thought, not understanding they were doomed. The nanites invaded the palm of my hand and the arteries in my chest, digging into my body. I could feel them tickling and rasping in my bloodstream as my dying heart pumped them throughout my network of veins like hot poison. I rolled onto my back, gasping. "You were not to slay him," Della shouted at Stott. "You disobeyed."
"He was controlling your mind," Stott protested. "I saved you, Della. Didn't you see him smile? All of you speak truly. You saw it, didn't you? His smile was pure evil."
I used the hand that wasn't stuck to my chest to reach up to Della. I beckoned her closer.
"He'll strike like a water slip," Stott warned her. "Don't go near."
She'd finally had enough of Stott, as had I. She kicked him in the face. I was impressed by the maneuver. She was quite limber, moving with the grace of someone who lives in the wild. Stott spun away, growling and spitting blood. Della bent close to me.
"What dying words do you have for me?"
I didn't smile. I'd learned my lesson there. Instead, I coughed some blood, then spoke as clearly as I was able.
"When I come back here," I rasped, "I want my knife back."
I was rewarded with a confused, worried look from Della. I'd managed to freak her out a little. I thought to myself that she was quite pretty in an unsophisticated way. As feral humans went, she was the best-looking one I'd met up with so far. Then I lost interest in my new friends. Some trick of my nervous system decided to let me feel the full agony of the bolt in my back at this moment. I twisted and cried out, but that only made the pain worse. Della leaned close and thrust her knife up into my skull. I'd been holding out a faint hope I might survive until that moment, when all hope was lost. In my final moments, I tried to absolve Della of the murder. I was sure she'd stuck me with her knife without malice, believing it to be an act of mercy. I heard the breath go out of my lungs in an elongated sigh. Then I died on that hot, flat rock in a sticky pool of blood and nanites. Chapter 14. The first thought that intruded upon the peace of my non-existence was one of irritation. That Stott fellow had been a true bastard. He'd been jealous, angry to see Della talking to a rival male. Maybe she'd spurned him, and he'd been a bloodthirsty prick ever since. I wasn't sure how I knew this, but I felt that it was true. The thought was clear in my mind as I came back to life. It was as if I'd been working on it during a long, turbulent dream, from which I was only now awakening. I was naked, but I wasn't cold. In fact, I was too warm. Sweat rolled off my new skin, pooling up on the steel tongue that I rested upon. My lungs spasmed, and I coughed wetly. Thick, choking liquid spouted, and I almost rolled onto the deck of the lifter's revival chamber. I found I was restrained and couldn't fall. Hanging by straps, I spit on the floor.
"That's not normal. Give me some numbers."
10 by 10.
"Can't be."
"That's what it says, specialist. Check it yourself." There was motion around me, but I didn't feel like opening my eyes. I was prodded, and needles were shoved into my arms, only to be quickly withdrawn.
His test numbers are good, said the biospecialist who was working on me. My bad. He's an acceptable grow. Turn off the recycler.
I heard a whirring sound that was dying slowly, like that of a power saw when the switch was flipped off. I frowned and opened my eyes, glancing toward the sound. I didn't see a saw blade, but I did see a stained maw nearby. It looked like a chute of some kind, one that angled away from the revival machine itself. The revival machine was behind me. Its mouth was warm and womb-like. Could that chute to one side of the chamber be where they sent the bad grows to be recycled? Had I ever been shoved into such a chute? Had a version of me with a very short lifespan been recycled and forgotten? I made a growling sound and tried to rise again.
Let me up, I said. I've got to go get my knife.
This seemed to amuse the staff. Did you lose it in the spine of one of the primitives?
No. And they're not primitives. They're just scared.
Scared of what?
Cephalopods from space. They come here and attack them. I've got to report to my centurion. Get me into my uniform.
Their attitudes changed when I said this. They freed me from the steel tongue, then helped me get my rubbery limbs into a smart cloth suit. I was out the door and staggering 2 minutes later. It was strange to be born again, to be back on the lifter, almost like I hadn't just been killed. I walked among groups of bored troops who sat in their jump seats. Some were trying to sleep while others played games on their tappers or ate sandwiches. Those I passed by weren't green soldiers. They'd all seen a man fresh from a revive. They made room for me and let me pass. Some had pity in their eyes, but none of them said anything. They'd all been in my shoes before. After passing two guardsmen without acknowledging their presence, I reached for the shaft that led up to the upper deck, where the officers held court. A thick-fingered hand reached out and clasped my arm. I swayed and almost punched the guy, but I controlled myself. "I have to talk to my centurion," I told them. They eyed my insignia.
"Graves is out of the ship. He's heading for the rebel camp."
"I have to talk to the Primus, then."
The guard laughed.
"You already died once today, McGill. Haven't you had enough?"
"No."
They shrugged and let me go. I could tell they were amused.
"Your funeral, buddy."
I struggled to get myself up to the second floor. I wasn't 100% yet. Normally it took an hour or two after a revive for a man to feel like himself again. When I finally found Primus Turov, she gave me a quick up-down look with sour eyes.
"What do you want, specialist?" she asked. "I made contact with the colonists, sir," I said. "They aren't the enemy." "I'll be the judge of that. You're not the only man they killed today. Did you know that your unit mounted a rescue effort?"
I shook my head. I felt my heart sinking. This wasn't going to be easy.
"We lost 6, she said sternly. "Only one of the enemy was taken down. It's embarrassing. I should demote Leeson when this is over."
Part of me hoped the dead one was Stott, and at the same time I worried that it might be Della. I took in a deep breath and tried to focus. This was important.
"Sir, I talked to them." "Indeed," she said. "I heard the details. It appears you managed to sweet-talk them into killing you. Were you aware that your comrades could hear your screams all the way down to the water's edge?"
"I was following your order, sir," I said. "Can I please make my report?" She eyed me, then nodded. I recounted the strange conversation I'd had with the feral colonists. She listened and frowned throughout. By the end, her expression became thoughtful.
"Do you believe them?"
"Yes. They've met up with the cephalopods, I'm sure of that. From the sound of it, they've had frequent violent encounters with them. That's why they live underground and employ traps and weapons designed to combat high-tech equipment. These nanite-tipped weapons would eat right through a squid suit."
"All right," she said. "Let's assume everything you told me is factual. What do you want me to do about it?"
"Call off the attack,"
leave them alone, and prepare to meet the real enemy instead. Who knows, maybe they can help us beat the squids when the time comes.
It doesn't make sense, Turov said, pacing around the small confines of her office.
I eyed her as she walked away from me. I couldn't help it. I oftentimes figured that when I died for the last time, I'd do so while staring at a nurse's butt.
What doesn't make sense, sir?
Why would the squids come here?
To kill humans?
Maybe.
But if that was their goal, all they would have to do is drop a nuke in each of these little valleys. They have the tech, I'm sure of it. No spacefaring race could have missed the relatively simple feat of building a fusion bomb.
I don't know, I said. Maybe there's a resource here they need. Maybe they come to mine it and leave.
She snorted and shook her head.
Not worth it. Hostile locals, a thick atmosphere, and significant gravity. No, any element they could get here, they could get somewhere else in the system more easily. Even fissionables.
I said, not sure why this mattered so much, but deciding to play along. Maybe they want oil. This planet has life. Maybe fossil fuels.
She scoffed again.
Are you serious? Crossing a solar system for oil? You're not as bright as I thought, McGill.
I wasn't quite sure how to take this statement. It was an insult, but it also indicated that she thought I was somewhat bright, making it a compliment of sorts at the same time. Irritated, I tried to come up with another reason.
Maybe they like to hunt, I said.
I've fought with them up close and personal. I know these beasts don't eat seaweed. They're predators. I'd bet my last credit on it.
She stopped and narrowed her eyes at me, nodding.
Good thinking, she said. That's possible. A hunter doesn't want to wipe out all the game. And the hunter will go for unique kills or trophies. Good work.
Primus?
What is it?
Why does all this matter so much? I asked. She looked at me for a moment as if deciding something.
Because the techs aboard Corvus discovered something.
They managed to regain control of the ship?
Partially. They managed to engage some of the sensor systems, but the propulsion and navigation units eluded them.
I frowned. So is Corvus lost or not?
Yes. It was a close thing, a valiant effort by the techs. The ship skimmed the corona of Zeta Herculis and cooked the last survivors. What matters is that they spotted something interesting, a single large ship lifted off from the water world yesterday. I'm thinking there's only one reason for the cephalopods to launch a ship right now.
My eyes widened.
You think they're coming here?
She laughed.
You just spent 10 minutes convincing me of the fact. Damn, McGill, shake it off. Get your brain in the game. This isn't your first revive, soldier.
Sorry, sir. I'll call off the attack on your vicious, burrowing colonists for now. But if they give us too much trouble, if there's any hint, Earth will be blamed for their misbehavior. I'll have to eliminate them. You understand that, don't you, Specialist?
I guess so, sir, I said. May I get back to my unit now? I moved toward the exit, but hesitated when I thought of Natasha. She'd been aboard Corvus, one of the many techs left there to attempt the repair work. I had been wondering if she was still okay or drifting out in space somewhere.
Primus, if Corvus was burned, how did you get your report from the techs?
We revived them here, of course. Once we knew there was too much radiation aboard for anyone to survive, we approved the action.
Right, but their minds, the backups, would have to have been stored aboard the ship itself, which was lost. How can they remember what happened?
She stared at me for a moment.
You're a thinker, aren't you?
She said.
Don't ask the techs about that sort of thing. They'll get pissed off just the way the bio people do. They have alien equipment of their own that isn't widely talked about. Let's just say
that the transfer from Corvus to our lifters occurred, despite less than optimal conditions aboard the ship itself.
Less than optimal conditions. That was a nice way to describe being bombarded by a million rads of gamma rays. No computer could function. No radio I knew of could transmit under those circumstances. Even if it could, a radio transmission would have taken hours to reach this world from the star. I left her office wondering about Legion Varus's tech. We seemed to have gizmos no one else did. Another thought followed upon the last one. Was all of it purchased with galactic credits? Or were we stealing bits of know-how now and then and using it on the sly? That might explain the secrecy. I filed these thoughts away in my mind and hoped that the revival systems would store them for me forever, no matter where I was in time and space. Since the attack on the colonist hideout had been called off and my unit was out on patrol, I spent the next hour looking for Natasha. There had been plenty of time for her revival, and she was part of the same unit as I was. I figured she was somewhere outside the lifter by now. I felt bad for her. She'd been left aboard Corvus, working desperately to repair the Skrull ship. The techs had made a valiant effort, but they'd failed and died in the end. I've died in some pretty bad ways, but I've never been cooked by radiation. That doesn't sound like one of the best on the list to me. It took me a while, but I finally located Natasha with my tapper and headed toward her coordinates without alerting her to my approach with a call or a text. Feeling sympathetic, I plucked a big-ass alien orchid the size of a basketball on the way and surprised her with it.
"Thanks," she said, taking the massive purple blossom from me and looking it over. It was waxy and thick, weighing about half a kilogram.
Natasha sat on a rock that was covered with a dry blue moss. Most of the rocks close to the lake had similar patches of growth on them. We'd been worried about the strange-looking moss at first, but our bio teams had assured everyone it was non-toxic. She wasn't totally living in the present yet, I could tell that right off. Her hair was still matted by the slime of a fresh revival. Mine was too, of course. It hadn't been a good day for either of us. We were both wearing light uniforms and long faces.
"Don't sniff it," I advised her as she toyed with the flower. "They look good, but they smell like a gym sock."
Natasha eyed the flower contemplatively. Her eyes were slightly glazed as if she was in a thoughtful, distant mood. She was calm, but I could tell her mind was numbly pondering the horrors of her last minutes aboard Corvus. I'd seen that haunted look before.
"Do you want to talk about it?"
I asked, gently. She looked at me as if seeing me for the first time.
"You died too, didn't you?"
she asked.
"About the same time I did. That means we're both fresh constructs of flesh. We've never truly met before, James. Have you ever thought of that? We remember having met, having made love. But those were different bodies that have long since decomposed."
I grimaced. She was going through a bad one, I could tell right away. Harris always said that the best thing for a revived soldier was to go right back into combat. That way, they didn't have time to think about what had just happened to them. I reached out and touched her.
"There," I said.
"Now we've touched. Now we're real." She rewarded me with a wan smile.
"Is that all there is to it?"
"I could arrange more when I'm off duty." Her smile swelled and transformed into a quiet laugh. I smiled back, feeling relieved. I didn't want her to freak out on me. Occasionally, troopers had to be sedated or even restrained after they were revived. I sat beside her, and she went back to eyeing the alien orchid I'd given her.
"It went badly in the end, James,"
she said suddenly, quietly.
"They let us fry up there. When we couldn't save the ship after a few hours, it was obvious. But Central didn't even try to let us escape. We were ordered not to take any of the lifeboats or the emergency pods. But a few of us tried anyway when we reached the Corona. Do you know what we found?"
I opened my mouth, closed it again,
and shook my head. They'd launched them all before you fled in the lifters. There was never a way for us to survive. We were left there to fix the Corvus or to die trying.
Are you sure you should be talking about...
Don't worry about your suit recorders. I'm wearing a jammer I built myself. Most of the techs have them. They're against regs, but it's so easy to build one, and even the tech officers look the other way. I guess it's a perk of being in charge of technology. We get to turn it off when we want to.
I thought about that, and it made sense. The computer people back home on Earth had always lived apart from the rest of us. They were the watchers, and we were the watched. Only they could avoid that fate. I sidled close to her and put an arm behind her. Not anything intrusive. I just wanted her to feel supported. She leaned back against my shoulder without thinking about it.
Okay. Tell me the rest, I said. What really happened up there?
In truth, I didn't want to hear her story at all. I was already pretty sure I would be pissed off and disgusted by the end of it, but I knew she wanted to tell me, so I let her.
We freaked out a little, she said. Discipline broke down. We're techs, you know. Like the bio people, we don't always have to play by the same rules as everyone else does.
Pretending to know what she was talking about, I nodded my head.
We switched off the neural transmitters first. That way, when they were revived, they wouldn't remember the final hour.
I frowned. Who is they? Who are you talking about? She shook her head.
Doesn't matter. I'm talking about the last of us. The techs who didn't want to fry. The ones who were the most upset about being consigned to death.
Okay, I said slowly. What did you do then? When your minds were no longer being transcribed.
I don't remember what happened. Only what we planned up until that point in time. My mind wasn't stored after that either. But I know there was a group of techs that weren't going to break ranks. They were all smug and self-sacrificing. They thought it was their duty to die horribly if that's what the Primus wanted. Others thought differently when the final moments came. We didn't think it was fair. And, well, I guess we lost our minds a little. Part of that might have been due to the growing radiation, heat, and fear.
The picture-perfect listener, I didn't move a muscle or make a sound. Internally, however, my guts were crawling. I hated imagining what it would be like to be trapped in what amounted to a giant microwave oven.
We had a plan to stay alive. It wasn't in the script, but we thought it might work. By separating the modules of the ship, we could give each part of the ship a jolt of lateral thrust, just enough to send one part of the ship away from the star. There would be radiation and heat, but we might have survived.
Sounds like a plan. Why didn't the others go for it?
Because Central Command had already set the plan. We were to be copied as soon as Corvus burned up. If some of us got off the ship inside the Corona, we wouldn't be able to report back whether we'd lived or died. It might have taken a long time to get the word back to the lifters that they'd made a mistake, that the bio people on Dustworld had made copies too early.
She looked at me then, and I began to figure out what she was talking about. There would be two Natashas if that scenario had played out. One out there in space, clinging to life. The other coming out of the revival machines here on this dusty rock. That would have been a violation of galactic law, I said.
Yeah, she said. It would have been. But we were going mad. You know what I mean? Sometimes the urge to live is too strong in a person. Even if they know intellectually that they'll come back in a new body, it's hard to give up on the old one.
She was right. I knew that feeling well. So, I said, how did it play out? I mean, obviously you failed and were revived here. She looked at me strangely. She gave me a tiny shake of her head. I froze.
You don't mean...
I don't know, she said.
I don't remember all of it, but that's because the neural transmitters were switched off. I do remember the plan. We were going to kill those who demanded to die on the ship. The plan was to reprogram their own buzzers remotely, to kill their masters. I mean, they wanted to die anyway. We thought we'd help them along a little. Then we would try to escape the corona. That's all I know, because my memories stopped in the planning stages of the mutiny.
My mouth hung open, and I stared at her. I lowered my voice to a whisper, even though I knew it wouldn't help if my suit was somehow recording my conversation despite her jammer.
Are you saying there might be two of you?
I asked.
One here in my arms, and the other one out there, lost in space and still alive?
She nodded and turned her attention back to the orchid I'd given her. She plucked a petal from it and peeled it back. Thick, greenish sap ran like syrup from the stem.
What will they do if they figure it out?
I asked.
I mean, which one of you is the valid, bona fide, genuine tech specialist, Natasha Elkin? You mean, which one will they execute? Probably that poor, desperate, murdering bitch who disobeyed orders and did her utmost to survive.
I heaved a big sigh and hugged her.
Stop worrying, I said. I can understand why you'd be upset, but it's all for nothing. There's only one Natasha, and I'm hugging her right now. You couldn't have survived. No one could have.
She looked at me gratefully.
You really think so?
I nodded my head firmly.
Absolutely. I saw diagrams of your flight path. There's no way out of a gravity well that big when you are so close to a star. You had a bad death, that's all. Just let it go. Would it be better if you'd been permed? I guess not, she said, giving herself a little shake.
She hugged me back, and one thing led to another. We'd only made love a few times before, but this time, there among the alien orchids on the mossy lake shore, she had a new fire in her. The sex was good, but I was a little freaked out. Could there be another Natasha out there, still alive and screaming in space? I had no idea. I'd lied to her about seeing diagrams and flight paths. That was pure grade-A Georgia bullshit. And I didn't know anything more about surviving in the corona of a star than I did about the rockfish in the lake nearby. I probably understood the fish better. Sometimes it's better not to know all the details when bad things happen. Was Natasha a murderer? Or had she chickened in the end? I prayed she'd never find out what had actually happened up there aboard the Corvus in those final, desperate hours. Keeping my thoughts to myself, I loved her, held her afterward, and I got her through the malaise that sometimes lingers in a soldier after a bad death. Chapter 15. I woke up with Harris's boot crashing into my side. I swear that man must creep up on sleeping troopers just to indulge himself in this kind of sport. Scrambling awake, I automatically reached for my hand beamer, but Harris's foot was already planted on it. Then I recognized him and cursed aloud. He chuckled at me in return. Then he looked over Natasha's kit, which was lying nearby. "A jammer, huh?" he said. She snatched her clothing and her ruck away from him and pulled her uniform on. She threw her shirt over her bare back like a shawl. The smart cloth flaps found each other and knitted themselves together to cover her skin. Both Harris and I watched this happen while she glowered back at us. Modesty was a funny thing in Legion Varus. You might take a shower with a girl, all the while chatting her up and enjoying the view, and no one thought anything of it. But if she had been caught doing something she wasn't supposed to, like screwing in the bushes on an alien planet, she got all prudish on you for some reason.
You could have said something to warn us, she complained.
And spoil the fun? Harris asked, chuckling. Two sleeping lovebirds in a nest of mossy rocks. I'm a sucker for that kind of cuteness. I took a few pics, hope you don't mind.
Natasha gathered her kit and left in a huff, disappearing into the thick, fleshy leaves that surrounded us. Despite her angry exit, I felt good about her behavior. She seemed to be back to normal. At least she wasn't wondering about her hypothetical twin, who who might or might not be cooking out in space somewhere at this very moment.
Get rid of that jammer, Spock.